In the coming months, the Utah Foundation will publish a series of reports on the quality of community connection in our state. These connections are often referred to as social capital. As it happens, community connections and individual connection were the centerpiece of a recent breakfast briefing sponsored by the Garbett Family Foundation and presented by the Utah Foundation. We heard from a remarkable panel of experts on mental health in Utah and beyond. You'll hear that discussion in this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard. Few would deny that our nation is heading in the wrong direction when it comes to various indicators of mental health. We've been seeing surging death tolls from drug overdose, increasing violence, increasing prescriptions for antidepressants, and rising suicide rates. And the events of the past 18 months, from public health fears to lockdowns to social unrest, have led to unprecedented spikes in some of these indicators. But are these national trends hitting Utah? To what extent has the pandemic and its fallout affected Utah's mental health? Are there emerging opportunities to improve access to mental health care? We hope today's conversation will provide us with a sober look at our mental health challenges and how we can address them. And we're privileged to have with us today three leaders in the mental health arena. So first, we'll hear from Julianne Holt-Lunstad. Dr. Holt-Lunstad is professor of psychology and neuroscience at BYU. She is a nationally recognized expert on the health implications of social connection and isolation. Julianne?
Well, I'd like to first start by thanking you for including me on this panel. And in light of the ongoing pandemic, of course, it's critical that we have evidence-based information to guide steps to help protect the public and of course, those who are most vulnerable. And so I'm grateful for this opportunity to share some of my knowledge of the evidence to help in these areas, in these efforts. Just to reiterate, as way of background, I am a professor of psychology and neuroscience, and so my area of expertise is focused on understanding the protective effects of being socially connected and conversely the risks associated with social isolation and loneliness. It's sometimes hard to believe that it's been about a year and a half now since the World Health Organization declared the pandemic and social distancing became part of our collective lexicon. And during this time, we've had to limit our social contact to reduce the spread of the virus. But with this, there has been growing concern about the secondary effects of social isolation. Importantly, the concerns about the effects of social isolation are not new. This was there was already substantial evidence of public health concerns even prior to the pandemic. I had the honor of serving on a National Academy of Science expert consensus study focused on social isolation and loneliness. And after a review of the body of scientific evidence, we concluded that social isolation is a major public health concern. And it's noteworthy that this report was published 2 weeks before the declaration of the pandemic. So for clarity's sake, I'd like to define a few related terms. Social isolation is objectively being alone, having few relationships, or infrequent social contact. Whereas loneliness is subjectively feeling alone. It's the discrepancy between one's desired level of connection and one's actual level of connection. So these can co-occur, but not necessarily. So what do we know about the effects? When it comes to long-term effects, we have robust evidence that social isolation and loneliness are independent risk factors for premature mortality, and social connection is a significant protective factor. So for example, my colleagues and I conducted a meta-analysis including data from over 3.4 million participants, in which we found that loneliness is associated with 26% increased risk, loneliness by 29%, and living alone by 32%. And this is increased risk for earlier death from all causes. Now, however, if we can remain resilient, these longer term effects may be lessened. So do we have evidence that loneliness actually increased? In a recent synthesis of 32 independent longitudinal studies, These findings suggest that on average, people did get lonelier over the pandemic, and more people reported feeling lonely compared to before the pandemic. It's important to note that these feelings of distress are normal. Humans are social species. We are not meant to be alone. The distress of loneliness is our body signaling a need to reconnect. Just like hunger signals us to eat and thirst signals us to drink water, loneliness is thought to be a biological drive that motivates us to reconnect. Throughout human history, we have relied on others for survival, and so proximity to others, particularly trusted others, signals safety. So when we lack proximity to trusted others, our brain and body may respond in a state of heightened alert. This can result in increases in blood pressure, stress hormones, and inflammatory responses, which, if experienced on a chronic basis, can put us at increased risk for poor mental and physical health. Unfortunately, during the pandemic, this has been particularly distressing because we may be feeling a heightened desire to be with others and few options to satisfy that biological need. It's as if we're thirsty and being told that the water is not safe to drink. Because of this, we have increasingly relied upon digital and remote means of connecting socially. However, the decades of evidence that document the immediate and long-term effects of social connections are primarily based on in-person contact. And many cases, this evidence predates the widespread use of digital and remote tools. We know much less about the equivalencies that these have. So as we are trying to establish new norms, caution should be taken. It's critical that we evaluate our efforts, whether they are digital or remote or not, to ensure that they are actually helping and not causing unintended harm. Thus, it's critical that we take this opportunity to work together to find effective solutions for this pressing problem.
Thank you, Julianne. Now we'll hear from Mark Rappaport, CEO of the Huntsman Mental Health Institute at University of Utah School of Medicine. Dr. Rappaport is a national leader in the psychiatric profession. Welcome, Mark. I hope that Utah is treating you well so far.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I very much appreciate this opportunity to talk with folks. And Julianne, that was a wonderful presentation you just gave. I'm going to take a different tact. Peter's absolutely correct. We're in the middle of the second pandemic. And the second pandemic really are the mental health challenges that are being faced. Some of these are due to isolation and loneliness. Others are due to feelings of lack of agency, a lack of a sense of control in one's life. Another factor that's been involved has been trauma and guilt. That's the bad news. The good news is, for the first time in many years, there's tremendous public recognition of the importance of the brain. There's tremendous public recognition that brain disorders, mental health disorders, are prevalent and important to treat and to learn about. So that's the positive of the second pandemic. We here in Utah, and I'm an old kid on a new block, having just arrived during the pandemic in January, we here in Utah have a unique opportunity actually to tackle not only the ramifications of the pandemic, but also mental health disorders in general. The Huntsman Mental Health Institute was founded by a collaboration from the Huntsman family, who gave a generous initial gift, the state of Utah itself, and the University of Utah that has been willing to say, hey, we're going to tackle something really tough. We're going to tackle the third rail of what's called health disorders, mental health. It's been something that other universities and other systems have shied away from. And here in Utah, there was a decision made, we're going to deal with it head on. The intent of the Huntsman Mental Health Institute is to be a nexus for everyone in Utah, for all of us within the state, and to serve as a resource for really tackling these tough problems that we're dealing with. Whether we're looking at the stigma associated with mental illness, child mental illness, and how do we prevent kids from getting ill? Remember, the majority of mental illness begins between the ages of 10 and 24. 75% of all mental illness begins then. We need to interrupt that cycle. Or if we're looking at how do we provide care for rural populations, let alone deal with the scourge and real trauma of suicide in our state, we're uniquely positioned to do this. We're uniquely positioned to holistically take on these challenges. And by that, I mean, we combine the brilliant work of Julianne and others with work in public policy, work in basic translational neuroscience, work done by schools of business and schools of nursing and social work together, so that we tackle all aspects of the problems that we face. That's what we're here to do at the Huntsman Mental Health Institute, is to provide a resource for talented investigators like Julianne at BYU, folks at Utah State University, Utah Valley University, what used to be Dixie. And we're fortunate to really be able to partner with wonderful peoples like Doug Thomas. And Doug's been a wonderful partner in this brief period of time that we've been together. So I guess my message to you is there isn't a better place to live to address mental health needs than our state of Utah. There isn't a better time to be here and for us to address this than now. We have a real confluence of amazing resources from our state, from our legislature, from brilliant scientists, from the Huntsman family, and the commitment of USHI and the universities here in Utah. I'll be glad to talk more about this later on. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mark. Now let's look at things from the state's perspective. Doug Thomas is director of the Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health for the state of Utah. Mr. Thomas serves on the board of the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. Doug, take it away.
Thanks, Peter. And thank you to Julianne and to Mark for their comments. They're both doing amazing work. And some of the key takeaways from the data, people that go through trauma and that have stressors and crises, typically their response is to be resilient and to recover and to manage through them. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't bumps and bruises along the way and that it isn't difficult. That does happen. But one of the keys to actually getting help and getting better, whether it's from mental, emotional injury, isolation, is receiving care in a timely manner. And that care can be both formal treatment and care, or it can be informal and kind of peer support or same boat therapy connections that can help. We're really focused on using, as was discussed earlier, the evidence-based research and finding the best ways to reach out to people to help them get screened and get connected to care when they notice that something's wrong, that they need some extra help. And really trying to also combat the stigma and the discrimination associated with reaching out for help. Too often, people don't reach out early in the process because they're afraid of what other people will think of them, that they're weak or that it's a moral failing or other things like this that are still, unfortunately, in our public consciousness, that we're striving hard with partners like Huntsman Mental Health Institute to address. Really, the other message we want to get out is that people are available. You can safely get care in person if you want, and that many people have made transitions to virtual care. And we're going to be analyzing our data from this last fiscal year where most of the services were done online. And we'll be looking closely at the outcomes on symptom improvement and social connectedness and general health and well-being in the public system to see how much comparison there is between some of the things that Julianne mentioned in her presentation. In Utah, we fared better than the nation. And part of the reason why was for the things that Mark mentioned in his opening is that we have transitioned to a statewide crisis line much earlier than the rest of the nation. 988 is going to be rolled out in the summer next year and change the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline to a crisis line. we've already done that in Utah. And so we think that because we've been ahead of the curve in some of these areas, we were more resilient. Our suicide rate remained pretty stable. Our fatal drug overdoses remained pretty stable. Emergency department visits, suicide ideation and attempts. We do know there is more anxiety and more depression and those things happening, but we're mitigating some of that through access to care, through informal supports and services as well. And that people are increasing their connections. We've seen increases in our call center, and those have remained pretty steady over the last 10 months. And since we rolled out the crisis line, it's been a trend of increasing people calling and getting help, which we're really glad to see. The frequent mental distress, which is more than just some, remained pretty stable as well during that time period. We're just excited to be able to share what's happening in the state and the nation with behavioral health. And it is, as both Julianne and Mark said, a great opportunity right now where the recognition is out there that we need to do more and that we can do more together.
Thank you, Doug. And I think there's some good news in here from the Utah perspective. It looks like we're bucking a lot of these national trends on these indicators that you looked at. So that's pretty remarkable for the state. Let's move to some questions and delve deeper into what we've heard so far. Imagine for a second that you're someone living 30 or 40 years ago. Your world didn't involve smartphones. It barely involved computers. That person couldn't have imagined the amount of time we spend on technology today, particularly young people. That person couldn't have imagined widespread pornography use, the rise of social media, the conversion of our national TV news into a profit model that sells drama, division, and despair 24 hours a day. What are the consequences of all these changes, and how do we respond? Julianne, do you want to start us off?
There's been growing concern over time, you know, well before the pandemic, about the increasing use of tech-based means of connecting socially and the effects of social media and other means. The difficult part is that because there are so many types of tools and apps and environments, it's really difficult to kind of say they're all good or all bad. But when it comes to, let's say, just social media, even that is very complex. There's evidence to suggest that that time spent on social media is associated with poorer emotional well-being, as well as greater loneliness. However, a lot of that evidence is correlational, meaning we know that they're higher use is associated with worse outcomes. But what we don't know is, for instance, is it that social media is causing worse mental health or more loneliness? Or is it that people who are more lonely are using social media more? And there could be some potential bidirectional. We have less evidence in terms of the long-term effects. And so it's really, I think, incredibly imperative that we look at these very carefully, because this is such an opportune time, especially as we have had to rely on remote means of connecting so much during the pandemic, that we critically evaluate these tools, because there's probably a lot of advantages in terms of efficiency and perhaps being able to connect with people who are not in the same geographic location, and those who may be homebound because of particular impairments. And so it's important for us to know and have a clear understanding of the strengths as well as the limitations, so that we can avoid some of these pitfalls and capitalize on some of the strengths.
Thanks, Julianne. Mark, you look like you were going to add something.
Yeah, I was going to say a couple of things. One is, I'll be honest with you, it's not new. If you look at our history as a culture, every time there's been the advent of new technology, it's taken a long time for our societies to really catch up to the advent of that technology. And so what we're seeing with the creation of the internet, the creation of social media, and the widespread promulgation of this new approach to interaction and communication is the fact that we as a society haven't caught up to how to deal with it yet, and how best to understand and cope with it and deal with the strengths and the limitations of it. At the same time that that occurred, one of the ramifications of earlier change, so for example, the airlines and cheap airfares, has been sort of a change in our entire culture and society. So some of the things that used to keep and protect people within a culture, i.e. the fact that many times there were families there for many generations and many different levels of family together to help support one another, no longer exist in our society, in the same degree at least. We'll learn how to appropriately take advantage of these changes in technology. A good example of how we have begun to do that is SafeUT. SafeUT is an app that is available to all children K through 12 and throughout our public universities and many of our private universities. It's available to frontline professionals who have been dealing with the COVID crisis and our National Guard. SafeUT has been demonstrated to save lives. It's been demonstrated to help with bullying in K through 12. So that's an example of how we take technology and use it positively and sort of advance beyond where we've been before. These types of challenges are not new. It's going to be how we cope with them and deal with them. And again, the size of Utah, the commitment of this culture to community gives us the opportunity to sort of lead the way in these areas.
So talking about these positive aspects of technology, in the past 18 months, we've moved away from the in-person interactions to Zoom or Zoom-like platforms. There has been a monumental rise in telehealth. Now, if I could ask you all to talk about the potential of telehealth to increase mental health care access. Mark, do you want to start us off on that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. One of the things that's been amazing about this pandemic has been the fact that we have rapidly shifted to telehealth, and that for many people, if you look at the satisfaction, for many individuals, they're as satisfied as seeing individuals face-to-face. The other thing that's been remarkable is that the adherence to showing up to appointments has actually increased because people don't have to deal with the time it takes to get into a car and go to the facility to be seen. In fact, both here in Utah and where I was previously at Emory University, the number of sessions that were successfully completed in child psychiatry increased dramatically. And part of the reason for that is all of a sudden the parents didn't have to take time away from work. All of a sudden there wasn't the transportation to and from. So there's real positives there. Actually, colleagues of mine at Hazleton Betty Ford have done some work comparing and contrasting in-person intensive outpatient programs for substance abuse versus their telehealth model. And their data, at least in the preliminary analyses, showed almost equivalent benefit from both models. The challenge we're going to face is going to be reimbursement. The challenge we're going to face is whether, one, the insurers are willing to understand that the benefit is just as great. Therefore, they should not attempt to decrease reimbursement for people using a telehealth platform in order to get their health care. The other challenge we'll face is there have been some legal constraints in the past, regulatory constraints against certain types of interactions with telehealth. And there was a loosening of federal legislation, 42 CFR, and other restrictions that really enhanced telehealth, including the fact that many states allowed providers not licensed in that state to provide care so that there would be continuity of care as people, for example, left school and went home to be with family. If we can tackle these issues, I think there's a tremendous opportunity to enhance rural mental health, frontier mental health, as well as the day-to-day access that underrepresented minorities and other groups have with a good telehealth model.
Thanks, Mark. Doug, what are your thoughts?
In our public system, the no-show rate went from about 35-40% to less than 10%. And one of the advantages also that's been explored a lot with Medicare is telephone only, so not even the video portion, which is showing similar results for seniors and their access to care. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I still practice a little bit to stay in the field and on top of things and understand how policy impacts practice. Last night, my last session that I was in at 8 o'clock, the woman I was with said, you know, I have to tell you, doing this over telehealth is just so nice. I can step away from my family, I can be in therapy, and I can step right back. Over and over, those are the kinds of data and information that we receive from families about trying to get childcare, lots of other issues, that it just helps solve so many problems for families and individuals that are trying to access care. We're working also with the legislature and some workforce committees around compacts so that there are compacts in place, because we have a workforce shortage right now. If you try to call and get into care, you'll find that there are big delays getting in to see a psychiatrist, getting in to see a therapist. The public system is actually probably has the most access right now. If you have insurance and try to call and get help, you might be scheduled out quite a ways in some areas of the state. And so these compacts allow for people, if they have a therapist and then they move, they can continue to see them in another state, and they don't have to be licensed in every single state. So we're exploring some ways to keep both continuity of care and access, to increase access to care through some of these means.
Doug, I want to ask you about state interventions with regard to the opioid crisis, but I also kind of want to throw the group a curveball here. Should we be worried about the mainstreaming of marijuana use? Are there mental health consequences to the more frequent use of much more potent marijuana? But Doug, if you could start us off on that.
The science is not there to back up and support marijuana for treatment of most things. I mean, that is what anyone will tell you. And the two scientists and researchers on the call can say a lot better and more about that than I can. But I can tell you that there's a lot of myths and rumors that get put out there about what it can and can't do. One of the most harmful ones is replacing opiates and using it as a replacement. All of the data and research shows that if you use marijuana to try to decrease your opiate use, you'll actually increase your opiate use. It's not an answer to the opiate crisis. What is an answer to the opiate crisis is medication-assisted treatment. The adherence rates and the outcomes are remarkable for medication-assisted therapies for both opiates and alcohol. Those are the two main ones that exist right now. They're being developed for other drugs like methamphetamine, and there are still great treatments that exist through talk therapy. And the University of Utah has actually done a lot of work around mindfulness and stress reduction and with pain, and seeing great results comparable to medicine. So we are concerned about the messaging around marijuana, and recognize that it is something that can be recommended right now for certain conditions by prescribers, and want people to be really careful and not prime their brain for addiction and other things.
Julianne, Mark, what are your thoughts?
Well, to some extent, I'll defer to the others because my research focuses specifically on loneliness. And in terms of the research on marijuana use and loneliness, there's less evidence. Some of the evidence that does exist suggests that it's perhaps not in the direction that one might assume. So what it suggests is that loneliness is associated with greater marijuana use. And maybe not the opposite direction. And so what that suggests is that it's not necessarily something that would reduce loneliness, but is actually associated with greater loneliness, although the directionality of that is not clear.
Thank you, Julianne. Mark?
I think there are a number of issues to understand. One is that we've had very little research in marijuana because marijuana was actually scheduled at the same level as the most serious drugs in the United States. And also there was only one source in the United States for marijuana to be used in research. That was a farm in Mississippi. What's happened, unfortunately, is that it's become popular and it's become sort of a fad to legalize marijuana. There are many components in marijuana. The two major ones that people have focused on have been THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, or CPD, which is really a cannabinoid form that are different. The cannabinoid form, the CPD form, does not tend to have an hallucinogenic effect, while THC has a very profound one. Over the years, since the 60s and 70s, there's been refinement in the growing of these compounds, and they're very, very, very potent forms of marijuana with much higher levels in THC than we've ever seen before. And they are causing people to have very profound hallucinations at times. It also is important to realize that there is an interplay between psychosis and marijuana use, and there is a link between worsening of psychosis, in particular schizophrenia, and use of marijuana. And that link does exist and has been demonstrated to date. There's some contention and some evidence that CBD itself can be helpful with certain forms of intractable childhood seizure disorders. And there's been an approval of that, not of marijuana itself, but CBD for that, or an extract based on that. There's some work suggesting that there may be some effects in terms of control of pain and pain disorders, but not for marijuana, but for this component, one of many components that's present within marijuana itself. We need to do a lot more research. We need to be very thoughtful and careful about this, because it is not necessarily benign at all.
Very interesting. One question is about higher education. How are we incorporating higher education environments in our mental health research, thinking specifically about the impact of remote connections, learning, and relationships for students who have been labeled as super spreaders or often spoke in less than flattering terms? Julianne, do you want to start on that one?
Sure. Well, one thing I'd like to start off by saying is that we know from many surveys, and this is true nationally and internationally, that the highest prevalence rates of loneliness are among adolescents and young adults. And, you know, combine that with the mental health data that was just presented earlier, this age group is certainly at high risk. And so our university students are, of course, a group that we need to pay careful attention to. I know that universities, just like other institutions and organizations, are struggling in terms of knowing how to balance the risks with the spread of the virus, with the risks of the of mental health concerns and emotional well-being. And I'll just acknowledge it, it sometimes feels like an impossible task. But ultimately we do, you know, our health, both physical and mental health, is the ultimate goal. And we should never pit one against the other. And that we need to find ways to navigate this in a way that that protects individuals. That is going to mean thinking outside of the box. Our typical ways of doing things may need to be reevaluated, and our typical policies and practices need to be reevaluated, and we need to come up with novel solutions. So I can just give you one example. In my own classes that will be starting next week, I am piloting a program for a blended classroom where we meet part of the time in person and part of the time online to try and give the benefit of in-person being able to be together, but also some of the advantages of some of the online, such as the flexibility and autonomy of when to do things, and potentially also limit the amount of time that we need to be together. And so, you know, time will tell whether how effective these are, but I do think that whether it's in our universities or our workplaces, our institutions, this is a time to really reevaluate how we're doing things.
Thank you, Julianne. Mark, any thoughts from the higher education perspective?
Sure. You know, I apologize because, again, I'm going to come across as a salesman for Utah. Commissioner Wolstenholme and the Yushi team have done an amazing job. They've already been working for the last 2 years with the Judd Foundation, which is a national foundation that's putting together programs for college and youth mental health. And so, again, it's a place where Yushi and the public universities and technical colleges here in Utah are actually moving to be ahead of the curve. So there's a great deal of work going on right now in Yushi, focusing in on these types of issues. I was in a meeting with a subcommittee of Yushi last week that was devoted to concerns about these issues and looking at new approaches for helping students and helping faculty and staff in the universities to deal with these sort of complex moving targets right now. There also are pilot programs like MH1. MH1 is a pilot program at the University of Utah where we've actually done what Doug was talking about earlier and created for the university mobile crisis teams that involves social workers and others that are available to our students essentially up until 3 a.m. in the morning, any day, 7 days a week. And there are other types of unique programs that Yushi and our state are looking at introducing for our universities at this time.
I would just add to what Mark said, in addition to providing the resources for the students, we're also working with Yushi and the deans, Dean Martel Teasley at the University of Utah School of Social Work has pulled together all the other social work deans, and we've increased the number of MSW students that will be coming out so we can start addressing the workforce issues. In the last year, we got an additional appropriation from the legislature, speaking about how forward-thinking they're trying to be, to increase that at the University of Utah and at Utah State University. And the nice thing about so the University of Utah is now starting an online program as well, so it will be able to reach rural areas of the state. And then the university up at Utah State University has their satellite campuses. And those satellite campuses are really the feeders for the rural areas where they are for a lot of these professionals. And so we are working closely with higher ed on both the research side, the stuff for the students, and then also the workforce needs for behavioral health.
We had a question come up about mental health care costs, thinking about both private insurance, Medicaid, and other levers. What are we doing and what can we still do to make healthcare more accessible by reducing costs. Doug, do you want to start off on that?
It's an interesting discussion to talk about reducing costs. The workforce is underpaid, the behavioral health workforce. And so some of that has to do with rates and rates they're paid. Really a big factor is getting everyone access to coverage, access to care. We have some pretty high uninsured rates in Utah still. And so that is a problem. The other issue is the amount of self-funded plans and high deductible, kind of catastrophic almost plans that we have, where you have to pay $7,000 out of pocket before your insurance will kick in because of these high cost deductible plans. And so I think it's working with businesses on this, and we've been working closely with the chamber and trying to help them understand how much impact behavioral health has on their bottom line and on their workforce. The largest disabling condition in the United States now is depression. And the most work days missed are due to mental health concerns. So it's in helping businesses recognize that if they put, you know, resources into their EAP programs, which a lot of people have access to EAP that's either free or reduced cost to them, that's kind of in addition to their insurance. So I would encourage people to look at their EAP benefits first. There's sometimes a limited number of sessions you can do, but it's a good start. And for some people, that's enough. There are some models that are moving to telehealth specific models. And when you do that, you cut out some of the overhead costs. But there are some models that are looking at that, or almost, I want to say, like urgent care via telehealth, kind of like urgent care for, you know, you cut your hand. And we're looking at models like that and how we can do that effectively as well.
Mark, Julianne, do you want to add anything?
I can just add that there was a 2017 study done by AARP that found that older adults who were socially isolated resulted in $6.7 billion in additional Medicare spending compared to those who are more socially connected. And so And that's just Medicare spending. That's just older adults. We also know that, as mentioned, that, for instance, social isolation and loneliness is associated with increased workplace absenteeism, reduced productivity. So the economic costs of this are likely much larger. And so, you know, documenting these costs may help organizations recognize that addressing these issues may also make financial sense.
Thank you. Mark, we'll give you the last word.
Thanks. There are a couple of points. One is to remember that we're talking about diseases of the most complex organ system in the body, the brain. We're not talking about character flaws. We're not talking about personality weaknesses. We're talking about dysregulation of the most complex organ in our entire body. Two, we know that individuals with unrecognized and untreated comorbid anxiety, depression, or substance abuse on top of cancer, on top of diabetes, on top of high blood pressure, on top of heart disease, massively increases the cost, and they're also less likely to get the care they need, the medical care they need. We have to flip the equation. We can actually save money. We can save money in terms of emergency room crowding and visits. We can save money in terms of length of time of people being spent in the emergency room. We can save money in terms of overall health costs by investing appropriately in a mental health care system that allows us to preempt a lot of what ends up being very expensive costs associated with brain diseases.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.